Sandy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Hand him on my whoa, 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 Andy, whoa, whoa, silver stream. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is artist Chris Chandler. His show Elemental Forms is on now through March the 2nd at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery in the Pearl. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Chris.
Well, thanks for having me, Joseph. Very nice to be here with you.
This show, Elemental Forms, it's based on typography. So people walk in, you've got these big prints, maybe 5 by 5 feet.
Yeah, big as 6 feet for this show, yeah.
And they often have like a big circle in them. It's like based, I presume, on a period. But there are other elements of typography in here. The first one, as you come in on the right, is very bold. It looks like a big black backwards capital E on a grey and white striped background with these two red circles that themselves have concentric squares, if that's a thing, within them. And then there are three other black elements on the left. Just, it fascinates me how this piece came about. So just tell us. And it's called number 64?
Well, it is. It's AB064, so it's the 64th piece in this Alpha Block series. So everything's kind of labeled in order as I make it. And AB stands for the font I used to make it. Alpha Block would have been a font you would have bought in the 1940s from American Type Foundry. They released this in a little lead type form, and it was modular. You could make your own letters with it and design your own, you know, font, basically. So I took that concept from the 40s and blew it up to make 8-foot letters, 10-foot letters out of these this font base that I made. Mm-hmm. So I'll take these letters, lay them out, and then scramble them to make kind of abstract typography, I guess would be the maybe a good general name to call it. So
what were the words you made with this font and printed out huge on your studio
floor? Yeah, I believe this one came about with a song from a band I kind of grew up listening to, The Clash, and it would have been one of their songs called Know Your Rights, and spelled that out in big, huge, 8-foot letters, and then scrambled it, stacked it, and broke it down to this little teeny 4x4 piece, you know. Looking at it, I don't know if you would recognize that as a letter or a word, but, it's a good starting point for me to make art, to have a spot to jump off from, so. Mm-hmm.
So you would print on a letterpress, big pieces of paper, put them on the floor, go up in the kind of loft part of your studio and look down.
Yeah, I like having everything on the floor, and I like maybe, kind of like a sign maker would do, go up and look at it from 20, 30 feet away. And everything's printed on a Vandercook letterpress from the 1940s. It's a pretty big letterpress machine, and compared to other machines, I can go 32 by 30 for my paper size. And then everything's kind of, we pasted together to make these bigger pieces out of that. Mm-hmm. So
this piece, AB number 64, yeah. It's a feature of all these pieces, is tears in the paper. So this paper's been glued down. You make your own wheat paste, right? You glue this soggy paper down, but it's torn. And where it's torn, you get these beautiful fibers of the paper sort of reaching out to each other across the little chasm. All the tears look like the cracks in a concrete floor, or they look kind of geological, and it gives it this texture which is so different from the flat kind of typeface world of, reading and not thinking anymore, like throwing paper away.
A lot of that inspiration comes from, I guess, when we were touring Europe a lot, you would see all the wheat paste concert posters all over the walls and the buildings, and they would not take the old poster down, but just keep going over it and going over it. And then these posters would start, and the weather and the rain would start to kind of break up and tear and come apart, and you could see kind of the history of what happened over the year or two of the different concerts, just bleeding through a little bit, maybe a word or an eye or something. And I always kind of, love that aspect of these posters. And then the tearing came about more accidental than on purpose. And I think kind of thinking about those posters and how things were put up back in the day with wheat paste, kind of let me down that path of tearing and revealing what's underneath, kind of a little hidden secret underneath, or little moments popping through to give it some depth.
Mm-hmm. When you talked about touring, you were on the road with certain bands that people have heard of, right?
I did it for about 30 years. I toured, worked in the recording studio and produced records, and then kind of switched from that to mainly being on the road, traveling and touring and doing live sound, doing production, tour managing, a little of everything. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who's some of the acts?
I would say the Flaming Lips I spent about 20 years with. They're out of Oklahoma City, kind of a psychedelic rock band. A couple bands from Portland here I did a lot of work with, a band called Modest Mouse, a singer-songwriter, Elliot Smith. I did a record and did some touring with him. The Flaming Lips teamed up with Miley Cyrus for a bit, and we did some runs with her.
Mm-hmm.
And a little of everything, so.
So you were like a sound guy on the road, right? But you were also making posters. How did that come about?
Well, I think in the 90s, to get a poster done, digital printing was still pretty expensive. And I wanted to do it in my garage. I didn't own a computer, and I still don't really use a computer. So I think anything that had to be done back then, you'd have to design it in a computer and get it printed. So a friend of mine, Bruce Leitcher, recommended an old letterpress machine. You can do it all yourself. So I went and found one and put it in the garage and started making posters and flyers for my bands and friends' bands. And it just kind of slowly took off to a fairly steady, you know, steady job, poster making.
So you weren't just trying to be retro and analog when you started. You were just, that was necessity.
It was necessity, yeah. I didn't have any other options. There was no other way to do it for me. So this way I could work analog, do everything without worrying about learning, I guess, Photoshop or Illustrator or any of that.
Did you just transfer your creative energy from sound into visual art?
Well, I don't think it was meant to be that, or I tried to do that, but it just kind of happened. When I kind of had my first year off the road after touring for 30-some years, it took a moment to get used to being home and not traveling. And then I got a call from a friend in St. Louis, said, bring your posters, we're going to do a show, and bring your, you know, it's a kind of art print week, and we want you to do a talk and show your posters. And I was going to do that, and my wife's like, it sounds kind of boring to me. You got to reinvent yourself and do something big and exciting. So I had this font and kept looking at it. It was a little font. I thought, well, if I'm going to do something big, let's do something big, and kind of re-envisioned it and started making these big pieces and brought it up to St. Louis, and people seemed to like it, and I just kept that momentum going and pushed it forward. So.
And the font was this AB, Alpha Block.
Well, Alpha Block, and then after a couple of years, I added a second font, which is a branch off of the Futura font called Futura Schmuck, which means, I think, Futura Ornament. So it's that one's from 1923. And that was modular shapes that you could use to either do letters or do maybe a little flair on your business card. Had a couple, you know, little triangles or something you wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So now I got two fonts. And I didn't change the name from AB to something different. I just kind of keep that same name, even though this one is all Alpha Block, but that one is a combo Alpha Block and Futura. So a little different, but yeah.
Let's look at this one, the one to the left of the one we were just talking about. So this is AB 57.
Yeah.
It's two very prominent black circles, and each one is backed by a sort of an elongated diamond that's been cropped top and bottom, and the circle obscures the points, which I'm hoping are underneath there.
Yeah.
The whole thing is on a gray background, which has another giant circle. There's kind of a whitewash. I can't even tell what layer it's on. It's so deceptive.
Yeah, that wash, or the wiping is on the top layer. And that wiping kind of came about by accident. I was wiping down one of my wood blocks, and I thought I cleaned it decent enough. And then I ran a blank sheet of paper, and I realized, I didn't really clean it, but it left these streaks and marks that I kind of really liked and embraced.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of gives the piece a little bit of movement to me, kind of windswept going across there a little bit. So I just kind of built that into my practice where I'll do these wipes on the paper first before I put my shapes on it.
Mm-hmm.
So
you have this, the black circles are very sort of defined and flat, but then the white sweeping marks, they look like they've been made by hand.
You know,
they have curves, they look like water ripples. Mm-hmm. And then you have the rips. There's one across the top and one across the bottom. They're kind of meandering shapes,
yeah,
or crooked like broken glass. How did you get these two tears?
Well, after the prints are done, and I'll dry them for, I would say, you know, maybe 2 weeks proper, depending on how much. There's a lot of black ink on this one, and the black ink for some reason takes the longest to dry, and it's very saturated, so I probably may have sat 3 weeks on this one. And then tears are fairly random. I mean, the tears came about a little bit by accident. I was working with a wheat paste artist, Max Collins, and he kind of suggested when we had the prints that didn't quite fit the piece of wood that we wanted to put them on, that we would tear and kind of push all the prints to the corner just to see if it fit and get a look for it. And
that was his thing as a wheat paste guy.
He told me he would wheat paste these buildings, and when he got a piece that wouldn't fit, he would kind of tear it and then push it to the edge so the edge is always lined up. He said, if you're looking up at a building and the edges are all there, that's the biggest part. So we kind of experimented with that.
So his tears were not visible to the naked eye,
but
the edges were.
Yeah, if memory crept, yes, it was more lining up all the edges, and it was more just making everything fit, you know, proper. And I think that's what we did, just to see how it all looked, and then I kind of started to fall in love with the tears and experiment more with them and see how far I could take it. Some pieces are torn a lot, some a little bit. I like revealing underneath, you know, the different colors, the different shapes underneath, the little transparencies that you get from it. So, and it lets you work a little more free. You can make the perfect print, but in the back of your mind, you know you're going to tear it. So if something does happen, you got this little backup plan, a little freedom of, I can still deal with that. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is artist Chris Chandler. His show, Elemental Forms, is on now at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery through March the 2nd. One of the pieces, the one in the gallery underneath your name, is way more colorful than the others. It's got orange, it's got pastel green, it's got navy blue in the middle. What were you thinking when you went all colorful?
Well, this was kind of came about when I get done with the print, I clean my print wood blocks. Instead of using chemicals, I run a blank sheet of paper. And then I run that three blank sheets of paper. One takes off most of the ink, and the second one pulls, and then the third one gets the last little layer. And then that way you don't have to mess up your blocks with a lot of chemicals, and kind of an easy way to do it. Now I'll have about 100 of these sheets of paper, and then the next time I do it, I pull them out and I clean a little bit more. And pretty soon, after 5 or 6 cleanings, they start to make this kind of accidental design. My dad calls it machine theory or art mechanica, because you're kind of a mechanic working and that machine kind of guides you a little bit through it. Mm-hmm. So this is one piece that would have come together from me cleaning the blocks. And it would have been a smaller piece, it would have been a 2x2. And then I really liked it. I put it aside and thought that could be a piece. And then I got some assistance from one of my friends, Will, and they run my laser and my computer and all that kind of stuff that I don't know how to do. So they recut the pieces in a bigger form, and that's it. So this piece came together from cleaning my blocks, the machine, and kind of just moving it up in scale. Mm-hmm. So that was accidental design. It just happened.
Is this a print, or is this done by a computer? What was the computer doing?
Oh, well, the computer recut out the shapes. Mm-hmm. So originally this piece would have been 2 feet by 2 feet. Mm-hmm. And I wanted it to be bigger, to have a bigger 5-foot piece in the show. So we just cut the shapes out. Instead of being, you know, a small piece, it became bigger pieces. So that's really it. We just, you know, grew it in size.
Mm-hmm. So. And how did he cut the paper?
All the paper, you know, for these, I just cut at my studio with a razor blade. Everything's still done by hand. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then just wheat paste, same as the others, just wheat paste it on. This one's a little more bold, obviously, more color. I think the show is getting a little dark, so Portland needs a little color in January. When you walk in, you get a little blast of that. I like that, yeah.
When did you make all these?
Some of these I started, I would say, about 8 months ago. This piece over here, the one we're looking at across from the colorful one, is that AB060, kind of mm-hmm. came about. I used this design before in a poster I made for a friend. And also, there's a building in Los Angeles I did a lot of the artwork for, and then they recreated this in a 60-foot tall, you know, in the front of the building, kind of as you walk in.
So, in what format?
Everything on the outside of the building. It's a 300-unit, takes up about 2 blocks building. They let me take it over and do all the art, you know, a lot of the art for it. So anything on the outside, we had a muralist recreate for me. And then on the inside, I brought all my, you know, paper and prints and wheat paste, and did a 30-foot install inside one of the rooms, and then 20 or 30 foot in the other room. Did a lot of, you know, handwork in it, and then The muralist did the other bigger pieces that we couldn't you know, fit in our print world. So
if someone's driving around in L.A., where would they see that?
Well, this is the one finished up. Actually, I should correct it. It's in Orange County. Sorry. It's on Beach Boulevard. Do you know Beach Boulevard out there? Kind of by, it's getting close to Huntington Beach. You know? Well, I could put a link up somewhere for it. I'll be flying down in a couple weeks for a photo shoot for it. So I'll get some more photos of it out.
So this piece is very big. It's a central kind of black column, and then you have these gold rhombuses alternating on this column. So it could be a bookcase, or it could be a sort of cross section of a building, or balconies on a building.
Architectural vibe to it. Yeah, I mean, this piece for me, I don't do a lot of color. I came back from my friend's party who had a very bling party, wanted everyone to be in sequins and done up, and it was beautiful. And I felt I tried to be inspired by that and do gold, and I call that pink. It's not really pink, but that's my attempt at being, showy and bold.
So. What kind of gold is that?
That's a gold paste that I get. It's smashed up gold that comes in this little lump. Then I'll add varnish to it and mix it and kind of create this gold paste, yeah. So I don't know exactly if they still make it. I think they stopped making it. So it might be one of the last pieces with my gold on. So,
is it like gold leaf, but in a different form?
It might be. I don't know enough about it. I know I just would get it as a gold paste. Yeah, just a clump of gold. Yeah, kind of this little paste. And then you kind of determine how thick you want it to be on the press, and you add your varnish, and you mix it up. Yeah.
So looking at this piece, number 60, you know, my mind just wonders. You told me it's on a building, so I started seeing a building. Yeah. But you have a whole different system of images in your head when you're working that the viewer might not know about. Mm-hmm. So just tell us that the next piece is a large gray circle, and on it are these 2, 4, 6, 8 squashed kind of rhombuses, very black. And then the background is, again, that kind of washy, pinky white. Mm-hmm. But to you, this began with music.
Yeah, this one was a drum beat at one time. My 8-year-old takes drum lessons, and we're always going over beats, and there's always kind of beats going through my head a little bit. So I'll sketch out a drum beat, with the circle being the kick drum, and then these pieces maybe being the hi-hat, and then I'll kind of scrunch them down into this little 4x4 musical segment. I don't know if anybody would look at that and think that's a drum pattern, but to me it's an easy way to come up with a kind of shapes that go together, or ideas that kind of have a flow to it.
So when you're with your son and you're drawing these things that a drummer would drum, are they triangles and circles?
My son just reads sheet music for it. So it would be like a musical staff. And so definitely not that, but I'll kind of repurpose it and take that musical staff and make it into the shapes that I can use, because I don't have, I guess I could make music notes and do it with that, but this is simpler for me, so. Mm-hmm. I think I like to stay in my lane. I've been doing, the typography thing. I love typography. You can bend it to, make whatever you want out of it, so I kind of enjoy that aspect of it, kind of seeing how far I can go with this, with this font.
So you use a lot of circles, right? Are they based on the period?
Well, this show a lot of circles, yeah. Some of their shows maybe not so much. And maybe this round I just kind of fell into that a little bit more, the circles, I just feel that shape works for me. I mean, so many great artists have, worked on a circle, and they're all different, and I just kind of like my own version of it, a simple circle,
It's not about finality?
Well, not for me, no. And I love breaking up the circles, so they're this one doesn't have a lot of the underneath, it's not broken up, but the top layer circles I love, kind of, as you see on this one here, these little disconnects, those little moments of breaking it apart.
This is AB062. It's the kind of mint green background with this. What kind of blue is that?
That's probably a closest to like a Prussian blue, I would say, something like that. Yeah,
big blue circle with, again, these squat triangles coming off the bottom. It's kind of like a Pendleton blanket, sort of regularity. But then you've kind of lacerated it. There's several cracks in this circle.
Yeah, cracks, and then underneath it is a graph paper. So I kind of love graph paper, and then we made our own graph paper and printed it, but made it a little skewed, so it doesn't quite, if you look closely, it's a little squished and a little broken and has its own character going on. So I would have printed the graph paper, and then we pasted that to the panel, and then the second layer goes on top of it with the tears and the transparency and that. So
the graph paper was white with red squares, and then the mint green layer, what kind of paper is that?
That is a mulberry Japanese paper, a sakushu, and that's a very kind of transparent, so you can see all the shapes underneath it, and it's a very long fiber, so in the tears on a lot of these, you can start to see. I love all the fibers that kind of leave these trails and directions if you look close.
They're beautiful. They look like fur.
It does, yeah. It has that you know, little directional and moments to it, so yeah.
Why do you use such nice paper when you kind of wheat paste people traditionally don't, right?
No, I don't think they do. I think this paper, to me, the ink lives kind of through it instead of on top of it. I think a lot of the Western paper is great, but to me, it just doesn't saturate as well. This saturates and soaks it in, so it almost feels a little more in depth to me, a little more live. We're in it and not on top of it. Like I said, that's the closest, I guess, I could describe why I love it. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Finally, there's one which is six circles on a black background, and then each circle has a different shape, a square, a triangle, or a cross.
And I guess this would be more the language of the show. I wanted to showcase a little bit of the building blocks. So these underneath are all the shapes I would have used to kind of put together the show. So if you look at this shape here, you could correspond to that piece there. And it's just a little bit of maybe seeing the process, seeing what's there, a little bit of a library to see where ideas came from. So. Mm-hmm.
Can you just say what a modular font is? You mean the little bits of metal for an F would come in several pieces?
It would have been a lead type you would have used. And if you bought lead type back in the 30s, 40s, 20s, it would have been one size. You buy that font, you're stuck with it. You buy that size, you're stuck with it. So modular came out to give you a little more freedom. You could take 6 to 8 pieces and change your font, and you could change your point size, and you could rearrange it. And I think the idea was great, but also when you're printing, instead of grabbing one letter, you had to grab, you know, 8 pieces to make a letter, so it took a lot longer. I think everybody might have been more of a time crunch back then. You're trying to get a job out, a newspaper, something like that. So I don't think it really took off. But I enjoy it for what I do, but I think I'm not doing greeting cards or anything, so I'm not on a time budget to try and put all this together either. So. Mm-hmm.
And you still do all the actual hands-on yourself?
Everything still, I still do it all myself. Every now and then I get some help in the studio, especially with, when it gets to more of the computer stuff and getting the shapes cut out on the laser. But most of it I do myself still, yeah.
You have great frames as well, these brown wooden frames. What do you call that kind of frame that doesn't show much?
I think they call that a float frame. Float frame, and that definitely makes the piece. I know once I have a piece and gets in the frame, it feels like it's done. It's really nice to have that option, to have everything framed up, and it just floats in there and gives it its own space. So,
How thick is the surface that the pieces are on?
I think it's 2 inches. So it's a big panel. Yep, it's a Baltic birch panel, and then that sits in the walnut frame. So, and I think the biggest I've done on the panels is 8 feet. I haven't really ventured out other than the installs. When I'll do an install on a wall, that can get up to 30, 40 feet. But as a panel to take home and put in your house or storefront, 8 feet I think is the biggest I've ever made. So,
What was Miley like?
Miley, she's great, smart, intelligent, works hard. People don't get to where they are in the world, I think, by not doing that. And I think, I was lucky to work with a lot of great artists that kind of give you a little bit of a roadmap of how to move throughout, either the art world or the music world or whatever you want to do with your life. You start seeing all these people that are famous in their field and do well, and they're the first ones there in the morning. They're the last one to leave at night. They are constantly working and reinventing and experimenting and trying, and any time diversity hits them, they come up with a better idea and a new solution. And all these things I think you learn on the road from these artists you can take with you into your art practice, and you start doing these things. You start showing up in your studio every day at 9, and you're there late at night. And when there's a problem, you figure out a way around it. So You know, that's one advantage I got from working with all these amazing artists. You really see how they got to where they're at and why.
Mm-hmm. So you, as a, doing sound, you would see an act and they put on a 90-minute show and the fans would go crazy.
Yeah.
But you saw all the sound checks and all the background humping gear and all that.
Yeah, all the moving the gear and logistics and being out on the road. Yeah, it was great. And I loved it for 30 years, but family and getting a bit older, not probably, you know, let somebody else jump in and do that for a while, you know, mm-hmm. make some room for the next person. So
are there any things in the digital world that you see and you just envy and wish you had mastered, like today?
I don't, you know, one reason there's so, like, we got PNCA school in town and they got so many smart people coming out of there that, you know, if I do need to get help, we have these wonderful folks that come over. And I don't need to use that space in my brain. I can save it for something else and do what I do and have fun and make these pieces.
You can outsource those kind of things?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I never went to art school. I never went to school. So, you know, there's so much in this town to get help on, you know, wheat pasting and paper and ink and the computer and photos. It's just endless. So there's such a good, Portland's a great town to be artists. You get all these wonderful, you know, insight and places to help you out. So mm-hmm. I think if I was in the middle of nowhere and doing this, I would never have gotten to where I am. So
do you find you kind of gravitate towards the highest quality materials? Like you have this letterpress that's ancient but still works, you know, valve amps and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Things that don't break down very easily.
Well, I know. I did make my juice in the morning with the juicer I bought in the 80s, and it still goes. I've had it forever.
What brand would that be?
I think it's Champion, and I just feel, you know, my stereo's been there forever. I enjoy that, you know, just to have, knowing that, you know, that system's been around since the 60s. I still use it. That press isn't sitting in a landfill. It's getting used and getting worked on, and I feel that, you know, it'll be there for the next generation, too, that want to use it. Mm-hmm. So I enjoy that.
But that must be how you approach art, right? Even though you make hundreds of copies that you stick hide in drawers, you know the final thing that hangs on a wall is going to be like rock solid and archival.
Well, I hope, yeah, everything, you know, archival ink, archival paper, the archival wheat paste, all that, yeah. And I think you learn that as you go. I think at the beginning when I made posters, I didn't do that. But I think as you slowly get more experience in the art world, you start gravitating towards those things.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was artist Chris Chandler. Chris's show Elemental Forms is on now at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery in the Pearl through March the 2nd. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus in person, Chris.
Well, wonderful. Thanks for coming out and having me. Very enjoyable. Thank you.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Have him on my whoa. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.